It is 8:30, and you are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle, and we are joined once again by Maria Tomchik.
Hello.
Co-editor Eat the State. I've done jobs things so long, I just about started saying, and columnist with Seattle Week.
Right. Good thing you didn't, because that's not...
Because you would have clobbered me. So, busy week.
It has been a busy week.
And a very busy week for those... excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. Mm-hmm. Busy week for those in the current administration.
Yes.
They are just spinning things left and right there.
They are hustling around trying to figure out how to make the stock market stop falling.
Which is quite the trick.
And actually, what they've been doing has been making things worse. In particular, Bush's speech this week actually made things much, much worse. And people don't really understand why, but it's very simple. There's a credibility problem when you have a president who has been caught with his hand in the cookie jar himself, coming out and saying that corporate criminals should be punished. Now, we can look at what Bush has been accused of. He sat on the board of Harkin Energy and also on their three-member audit committee. So, I mean, when I first heard he sat on the audit committee, I thought, 20 people maybe. But there were three people, which means he had to have known what was going on. You know, when you sit on a committee that small, you are made to do some work. You're not just sitting there taking up space. So he sat on the audit committee when the company booked some very fishy revenue that they shouldn't have booked. He also has been accused of insider trading, and he claimed that he didn't know that the company was in trouble when he sold his stock, but now it came out. You can look in this morning's PI, or perhaps it's also in the Times, that the president of Harkin Energy sent him a letter 4 days before he sold his stock telling him that the company was having cash flow problems and was in trouble with its creditors and was going to have a really bad quarter. So, and Bush turned around and sold his stock 4 days later. So it's quite obvious that he's involved in insider trading.
That's probably about how long it took him to find someone to read him the letter.
Right, and explain to him exactly what it was all about.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, and his defense has always been that he consulted with the lawyers for Harkin Energy before he sold his stock. Well, I'm sure he had to have them interpret for him the things that were in the letter, but it was probably pretty obvious to him from the get-go that there was a problem and that he needed to make the sale. So he's not so much of an idiot that he can't figure out when his interests are at risk, so... And then, in addition, it came out this week that he got cheap loans to buy that stock in the first place from the company. And here's Bush talking about how corporate officers should not be able to take loans from their own companies when he himself took a loan from his Harkin Energy, from the company he sat on a board for, in order to sell his stock in an insider trading deal that made him some nearly $1 million. So he's obviously as filthy as the WorldCom and Enron executives. And then this week when he was being pushed on his Harkin Energy dealings, he had the nerve to say something that really, I think, unnerved investors more than anything that's happened in the last week. He said, quote, "Sometimes things aren't exactly black and white when it comes to accounting procedures." Now, I mean, accounting is done so that people who run the company and the investors and the SEC and the government and in publicly traded corporations, you do accounting in order to tell everyone what you've been doing during the year, where you are, whether or not you're making a profit. You want it to reflect reality as much as possible. You want it to be as close to black and white as you can get. But that's not the case. That's not what U.S. firms have been doing, and it's not what our accounting industry has been selling them as a product. They've been selling them ways to make accounting more and more and more vague so that they can get away with more and more weird deals to fudge their books.
So what he said there sounds like it wasn't just that he was stupid about the concept of accounting. It sounded like he
understood exactly
how things really go,
how things really work, and he himself was complicit. So he was basically saying, yeah, look, this is how it is, folks. This is a systemic thing. Our accounting system is dirty, and you got to accept that. And that really, I think, made investors just just crazy, you know. So when he gave his speech, people had that, all of that on their mind when they were listening to him. Now, there was another thing about his speech. It was mostly image. you know, he used a lot of words like freedom and responsibility, and he had this big background behind him with, you know, corporate responsibility splashed all over it. And he, you know, had the nice grave presidential demeanor, but his speech had very, very little of substance. And I think investors and the general public really want substance right now more than anything. They're really looking for somebody to say, okay, boom, 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 this is what we need to do to fix the problem. You know, and he gave none of that. I mean, he gave some steps, but they were very, very... Well, I'll talk about that here in just a second. But his speech was mostly image, and people really, really reacted to that. Now, his proposals, the things that he did propose, were basically without teeth to them. There wasn't much there for anybody to latch on to as a real solution. He talked about doubling sentences for executives convicted of fraud. Well, so what if you know that nobody's going to be convicted of fraud? Because how many people have been convicted of corporate fraud, of accounting fraud in the last 10 years? You know, it's not like there haven't been cases. There haven't been investigations. It's just that no one gets convicted. No one goes to jail. And there's a basic reason for that. Who's going to testify against the boss? Furthermore, what other colleague, what board member, what upper management person is gonna testify against a man who has done something that they themselves have done? You know, it'd be like turning yourself in to the FBI. I mean, they're not gonna do that. And we saw that, we've seen that in the last several months with Jeffrey Skilling and Kenneth Lay pleading the fifth, and with Bernard Ebbers and Scott Sullivan of WorldCom pleading the fifth. I mean, they're not gonna talk. And if they're not going to talk, where's the evidence going to come from in order to convict these guys? So that's really a non-issue. Another thing he proposed was preventing officers of corporations from receiving loans from their companies. And that's a joke, because, I mean, he received a loan from Harkin Energy. So that's a pretty hypocritical thing to say. And, of course, there's nothing like that going on in the congressional legislation that's being passed. No one's even looking at that as an issue. He proposed that disclosure of CEO compensation should be done. Well, wake up, George. That's being done already. I mean, CEOs do already have to disclose what's in their compensation packages. That's not the problem, okay? He said that he proposed that just a measly $20 million should be given to the SEC this year to help them investigate corporate fraud. But, you know, that's really peanuts. The SEC has about a $700 million budget, and there are 900-plus corporations that turn in quarterly financial statements. So every 3 months, they got to look at the books of 900 separate corporations and try to find fraud. And we're not talking about 3- and 4-page filings. We're talking about 50, 60, 200, 300-page filings from each company. So that's insane.
I thought what was interesting about that was, my understanding is back in March, the SEC had asked the administration for a chunk of money to increase their, you know, mm-hmm. their budget and stuff, and the administration had turned them down at that point. So I find it kind of ironic, if nothing else.
And they asked for much, much more than $20 million. $20 million is almost nothing compared to what they really, really need.
Yeah, that's like what... Cheney's stock holdings from Halliburton, you know.
From Halliburton, yeah. Halliburton. Probably. Bush also suggested barring members of the board of directors from having a financial stake in the company that they're sitting, whose board they're sitting on. And that's absolutely laughable. I mean, there's, if you know how people are attracted to sit on a board of, on the board of directors for a company, you know that they all have a financial interest in the company. That's the only way you get them to take time out of their busy lives to sit on the board of a company, is to give them some kind of a financial stake. So that's never going to happen. I mean, there's never going to be, Congress will never do it, and Wall Street will never do it, and companies will never do it. That's just something that Bush threw out there for show. And then finally, he proposed a Justice Department task force to focus on financial crimes. That also is quite funny, because right now the Justice Department is swamped with terrorism investigations, and in fact there's been concern among local police departments that they're not investigating bank robberies and serial murders, things that they should be looking at, that they're leaving up to local law enforcement agencies who don't have the funds to tackle. And now Bush wants them to look at corporate crime, And in addition, the man that he's proposed to head that task force is a defense attorney for corporate criminals, including Enron. This man has also sat on the board of Providian, a credit card company that just settled a lawsuit for $400 million for corporate fraud. So the guy who wants to head the task force is himself as dirtier, actually, than George Bush and than most folks you could think of to do this kind of a job.
A lot of experience with corporate fraud.
Yeah.
Some people would see that as a good matchup.
Uh-huh. And then the rest of us see it as not being serious, as being absolutely not taking this whole thing seriously. And the things that he didn't talk about are probably more important. He didn't talk about stock options, which is one of the big hot topics right now, not just on Wall Street, where investors are really miffed that most companies can pretend that stock options are a freebie that they give to employees. They don't treat them as wages. They don't take them as an expense on their books, you know? And they should be counted as an expense on their books. And it's also being looked at in Congress, where Senator John McCain is pushing for that to be included in the Senate version of the bill going through the Senate now. He didn't talk about limits on executive pay. He didn't talk about a ban on stock options for upper management, which is what has led directly. You could argue that's led directly to the problems we're seeing today, that because upper management has had a vested interest in the stock price of their company, they've done everything they can to inflate the stock price, including fraud. That has not been addressed. That was not addressed in Bush's speech and is not being addressed in Congress. And most importantly, he's not talked at all about a change in the accounting system or any kind of increase in enforcement. I mean, he's talked about peanuts for the SEC, but he hasn't talked about any new board to oversee the accounting system or even the way the accounting system is supposed to look at, analyze, and enforce accounting principles within its own industry. That's one of the big things that is not being discussed at all and needs to be addressed.
So I have a question, because you were talking earlier about the stuff he's done, especially his comment about accounting not being a black and white art. That makes investors nervous, and then we basically feel the brunt of that. But shouldn't these investors, I mean, aren't these the same investors that should actually know one way or the other what's kind of going on with the market and with these big corporations? And does that make sense? Shouldn't they know better already? And why should they, you know, necessarily
well,
have
that's,
to?
Well, that's the deal, is that they should know. But they can only go by what the corporations give them. They can only read the financials and draw their conclusions from that. They can only get on the phone and talk to someone like Bernard Ebbers and ask him questions about the financial statements and take his answers and as the truth. I mean, they can grill him and they can decide whether or not they believe him. But who would have guessed at some of the tricks these guys have used? I mean, who would have guessed that Merck, for example... this past week, Merck said that I believe it was $12.8 billion, that they were actually booking revenue, that they were booking money as income, payments that were not being made to their company. They were payments being made to other companies, to pharmacies that they do business with. Who would have guessed? I mean, how could you ever guess that they would do something that fraudulent, that openly wrong? I mean, and that is not even against current accounting principles. That actually is okay according to current accounting principles. You know, I mean, our accounting system is a shambles.
So you're not expecting anything real dramatic to come out of
the legislation? No, I'm not. There's the legislation that passed in the House to supposedly reform a lot of these problems, to supposedly address a lot of these problems. It was very weak. There's legislation going through the Senate right now that's a lot tougher than what was in the House, but it still doesn't address these problems that we've talked about. It doesn't talk about stock options, doesn't say anything about reforming the accounting system at all. And it still has to be reconciled with the House version once it passes the Senate. And then there's also the question of whether or not Bush would sign it once it passes. And I don't think, and you know, whether or not it would survive, whether or not they'd be able to override a veto, too.
All right. Well, normally we would never touch the reports coming in on a daily basis at corporate media about stock market. Stock market's up, stock market's down, stock market's, you know, the same as it was yesterday.
Stock market's seesawing.
Yeah, let's show you some footage of people at the stock market. But
let's show you the value of some companies, you know.
Yeah, that you could afford to buy a couple shares of.
Maybe. if you didn't have to pay rent.
But this week, so it sounds like it's a little more significant story.
Yeah, this past week, the Dow started dropping, and it dropped for five straight sessions in 5 days. And nothing seemed to make it stop. And this past week, it lost 7% of its value. In the past year, it has fallen more than 40%. And the stock market hasn't seen this kind of a fall since 1974. So that's pretty bad, folks. when you look at in terms of the history of the stock market, that's a pretty bad fall. There's some reasons for that. People are wondering, you know, how come the stock market keeps falling? Is it just investor worries? You know, I keep hearing reports that the economy's getting better, but the stock market's in the toilet. What's going on? Well, the truth is, there could be several things going on. For one thing, the economy may not be getting that much better. You know, people talk about how accounting is so iffy these days that we don't know whether a company's lying or telling the truth when it releases its financials, but we don't ever ask that question about government statistics, particularly statistics about unemployment and consumer spending. The government's statistics on these things are looking pretty good, but then independent statistics, like this week the University of Michigan released its consumer confidence report, are going in the other direction, are saying that things are not so rosy. So when that happens, investors respond. So there's a question of whether the stock market is the real barometer of how the company's doing in the recession. Also, I think people are seeing an increasing number of homeless on the streets. I know I'm seeing that. And that's making you wonder, wow, you know, maybe things are not so good as they're saying. So there's a lack of confidence in what's being said about the economy. Also, it seems like every week is bringing us a new corporate scandal. This week it was Merck and their Medco unit. It was $12.4 billion in revenue that they booked that didn't belong to them, which is just still astonishing to me that they could think that they would get away with that. But it seems like each new report tops the last one in terms of how much money is involved and how bad it was and how weird and how fraudulent. And the interesting thing about the Merck thing is that PricewaterhouseCoopers was their auditor. They couldn't even say that it was Arthur Andersen that led them down the wrong path. And the fact that PricewaterhouseCoopers, their auditor, and the company itself said that it shouldn't be a problem because it adhered to generally accepted accounting principles, that also makes investors throw up their hands and say, well, what's next? You know, if our accounting system allows this, you know, what else could be going on? But investors are also recognizing now that the U.S. system is rotten and they're starting to move their money abroad. This is something that is not being talked about in a lot of the business press. But in 1997, when there was a big Asian economic collapse, maybe people will remember that, 97 to 98, there was the big collapse starting in Thailand and moved throughout Asia and into Russia by late 1998. And investors were having to move their money out of those markets and into the U.S. market in order to find a place where they could be sure that their money would be safe. That by 2000, early 2001, that world recession was finally being felt here. So our bubble was beginning to burst in late 2000, early 2001, and now we see investors saying, "Well, gosh, you know, the reason I moved my stock out of Thailand or Singapore or Russia was because of crony capitalism. And that term crony capitalism refers to companies that could buy whatever kind of financials they wanted from a rotten accounting system and could buy favors with the government. And there were banks that were not providing much oversight for their loans and so forth. That crony capitalism is here in the United States as well. And so now it's time to move my money abroad. And a lot of the places where big investors are taking their funds are Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia, right back to where it started in Thailand and Indonesia and places like that. So basically, big investors move their money around the world. They don't keep it in any one spot. And right now, we're seeing the brunt of that with our stock market collapse. We're seeing a lot of selling by investors who want to safeguard their funds, want to get a return from somewhere, and they're going to move it wherever they think they'll get that return.
Can you define investors for us? Because I think, myself included, that a lot of regular people like to think of themselves, you know,
people,
as investors.
Yeah, people with pension funds or who have
sure.
a little bit of money in their
IRA.
Sure,
I've
had
a couple stocks. I'm an investor.
Yeah, no. In fact, you are a penny investor, which doesn't matter much to Wall Street. When they talk about investors, I'm really talking about, and the business press is really talking about millionaires, billionaires, large pension funds. I'm talking about something like TIAA CREF, which manages, it's a pension fund that manages money for public school employees and a lot of public employees around the country, millions and millions of people. And they manage huge amounts, they manage huge amounts of money, and they have the ability to make markets drop just by selling one of their holdings, selling out one or two of their holdings at a time. So these are the big investors, institutional institutional investors like large pension and mutual funds. Say you own a few shares of a Vanguard investment fund, for example, maybe one of their index funds. Vanguard manages lots and lots and lots of mutual funds. Those guys sit down together and they decide what stocks to invest in and how to manage their funds. And when they decide that it's time to sell out of an industry or sell out of a stock, they do it all. They often will do it all at once, and that can make a big impact on the stock market. That's what's happening right now, is that they're bailing out on a lot of these risky stocks, but they're doing it all at once.
And how many big investors would you say are out there? Are there thousands? Are there hundreds? Are there, you know, tens of thousands?
I don't have a good sense of how many there are, but I do have a sense of their impact on the market, and their impact as opposed to someone who owns a couple of stocks or who has an IRA or who invests in some mutual funds is it's a way larger impact than someone like you or me could have.
All right. Anything else on that, or we still have...
No, let's move on.
All right. Got about 5 minutes left. Homeland Security is being scrutinized by multiple committees and...
Not only did Bush's speech bomb, but his Homeland Security plan is floundering in the House. There are 12 House committees this week who are working on plans for the Homeland Security Department. They were the various committees that whose departments will be affected when bits and pieces of different agencies are taken away from them and put together into the new Homeland Security Department. Those committees were supposed to sit down and figure out how the move is going to be made and which portions of their departments were going to be moved. It turns out that a lot of them don't want to move any of the pieces of their departments. For example, the Coast Guard, the Transportation Department, decided they didn't want to lose the Coast Guard because the Coast Guard's primary role is search and rescue, not anti-terrorism intervention. FEMA is an independent agency, and several committees said, well, FEMA shouldn't be removed, shouldn't be denied its independent status because it really doesn't have anything to do with anti-terrorism. It deals with relief from natural disasters. The Department of Agriculture wants the animal and plant health inspectors to stay in the Department of Agriculture where they belong. The health research should stay in the Department of Health and Human Services. That makes complete sense. Committees decided against moving the INS, saying that it should stay right where it's at. They did vote on one move, They voted to shift the Secret Service from the Treasury Department to the Justice Department instead of the Homeland Security Department. So it's looking like there's not going to be very darn much in the Homeland Security Department, and that Bush made his proposal prematurely without really thinking about what was going to happen and the kind of resistance that was going to be thrown up in the House. But there's a special committee that's going to actually put the legislation together, and the guy who's heading that committee is Dick Armey, the House Majority Leader. He's a Republican from Texas, Bush's home state. So all of that could change. He could decide to move all of these agencies into the new Homeland Security Department, but then there will be a big fight on the House floor over it. So we'll see what actually happens and whether or not they can get it done before the August recess, which I highly doubt. So, and then also this week, the Congressional Budget Office released a report saying that the startup costs for the new Homeland Security Department was going to be $3 billion over 4 years instead of $0, as the Bush administration asserted. So,
yeah, I think we can count on some really good stuff from Dick Armey. I mean, he's been so outstanding on so many other issues.
Yeah, no, I'm not expecting much from him.
All right. Well, Counterspin covered it for about half the show, but Yucca Mountain.
Yeah, I don't think that they gave this information, so I'll just give it to you really quick. Everybody knows by now, if they'd been listening earlier, that Yucca Mountain nuclear waste site has been approved by the Senate. That's not the final hurdle. It's the final political hurdle. There's still lawsuits and the licensing process to go through. But for political purposes, it's a done deal. I think people should get on a website and look. So get out your pen and pencil. I'll give you the name of the website here. You should look at how close these nuclear waste shipments are coming to you. And the Environmental Working Group, that group that I think a couple months ago I gave you their website for their database on agricultural subsidies, they have a new database that shows nuclear waste route maps, and it's quite detailed. It'll show you. In fact, I put in my address, and it showed me the route. It showed me how much of it was going to go on highway, how much on rail. It showed the number of people who live within a mile of the route. It showed hospitals that were nearby. It was amazing. It's at www.ewg.org. That's the Environmental Working Group's website. And you can just scroll down a little bit, and there's a little link to it. They're nuclear waste route maps. So that's something everybody should take a look at. Mm-hmm. Also, I thought it was kind of interesting that our two state senators split over the issue. Maria Cantwell voted against the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste site, and Patty Murray voted for it, which I think points up the difference between the two senators. Maria Cantwell actually knows about technological issues, whereas Patty Murray is pretty dim bulb. She just is not. She just votes kind of by reflex, what her major political contributors want her to do, and she doesn't really think it through.
Mm. She's not real good on nuclear issues.
No.
And all that comes just, I know, a few weeks back where they had a truck full of radioactive materials going from a banger that spilled on the...
Yes.
You know, technically, it was contained as far as we can gather, but it definitely had an accident there.
Yeah, just, tell that to the people who live nearby.
And just, 3 or 4 weeks after Yucca Mountain had an earthquake, 3 or 4 weeks back, mm-hmm. a 4.7.
Yeah, Yucca Mountain is supposed to be geologically safe. It is not anywhere near being geologically safe. The most horrific thing about this whole proposal is that it's not even going to take care of all of the nuclear waste that needs to be disposed of. It's only going to take care of a tiny fraction of it. So there's still going to be stockpiles of nuclear waste all around the country, even after Yucca Mountain is full. So there's really no reason to put waste in a place that is that dangerous, or to move it around on trucks and on trains.
Yeah, let's spread it out over our highways.
Let's expose everybody.
Okay, talking once again with Maria Tomchik, who is co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, what is Eat the State?
Eat the State is a small biweekly newspaper that we do here in Seattle. You can find it in cafes, bookstores, coffee shops, bars, various places around town. You can see us on the web. Our website address is www.eatthestate.org. And our phone number is 903-9461 if you want to call and give us comments.